Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Langetam, Nisan Bolivinaka, Talohani, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation, also known as Melbourne. I'm your host, Aggie Tupou, and glad to have your company. Up on the show today, domestic violence, now a national crisis in Papua New Guinea. It's the breakup many saw coming as New Caledonia's pro-independence coalition splits. And COP30 climate agreement meets mixed reviews. More on those stories shortly. But Korabwa, thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, in Papua New Guinea, the government is warning domestic violence has become a national crisis. A new report found more than 60% of women have been abused by their partners, more than double the global average. It also found reports of gender-based violence has increased by a staggering 210% in the past four decades. As the government finalises a new 10-year plan to combat the issue, PNG correspondent Marion Farr speaks with people on the front line. And a warning, this story may be distressing to some listeners.
Fiona has been with her second husband for more than 7 years. For safety reasons, she's not using her real name. She says the abuse started early in their relationship.
He keeps weapons nearby, a long machete, rubber hose and belt. He puts it near the lamp and sleeps. If we don't have sex, he hits me. If I refuse sex, he hits me.
Poverty and his controlling behaviour have kept her trapped in the cycle of violence and physical abuse.
He would lock the door so I cannot get out.
It's impacted her and her youngest son.
When other children would eat ice cream or soft drinks or chew lollies, I would take my son away. I don't want him to see them and beg them to share.
While harrowing, Fiona's experience isn't unique in Papua New Guinea, where gender-based violence has been declared a national crisis. Shirley Cowper runs a safe house in the capital, Port Moresby, and says the issue is getting worse.
The escalation of violence is going like 100 steps ahead of us.
A new government report sponsored by the UN found rates of domestic violence have increased by 210% in the past four decades. It also found 64% of women in 2025 experienced intimate partner violence, more than double the global average. Shirley Cowper says across PNG, frontline services like hers are underfunded and overwhelmed.
Even though we don't have money, we don't have budget, we don't have resources, but at least we can provide you something.
Another example is the Police Family and Sexual Violence Unit. Its budget for this year was just $100,000 for the entire country to cover both wages and operations. Shirley says that's clearly not enough.
Policemen or a woman that works in the FSVU, there may be two and three in the FSVU, and you are looking at almost 100 survivors coming a day, and they are burnt out.
Fiona says she reported her husband to police once.
There was a time he came after drinking and beat me up with a metal rod.
He was arrested, she says, but bailed himself out and the police didn't follow up.
He came back and continued to beat me. He got cross to me, continued the assault.
PNG police did not respond to the ABC's request for comment. The PNG government is now reviewing a new 10-year strategy aimed at reducing gender-based violence, which will cost $65 million annually. Powers Parkop is the chair of PNG's Permanent Parliamentary Committee for Gender Equality and Women's Empowerment, which has been driving the strategy. He says key reforms include bolstering police, building more safe houses, programs for perpetrators, and better coordination of funding.
If we put all the funding together through the GBV Secretariat, then they will monitor it and make sure that it's having impact.
That's after the last 10-year strategy failed to meet its objectives, partly due to government funding delays. Shirley Cowper says that must not happen again.
We want the leadership to be improved. We want the budget to be permanent.
And that is Shirley Cowper from the Magna Carta Safe House, ending that report by PNG correspondent Marion Farr.
Pacific Beat.
Well, COP30 has ended in Brazil. A climate agreement has been reached, but it's received mixed reviews. The deal boosts financing for poor nations coping with global warming, but omitted any mention of the fossil fuels driving it. There was also drama prior to the final day with fire breaking out at the venue. So on the line with us from Belém to talk all about this is Greenpeace Pacific head Shiva Gandan. With that, thanks for joining us, Shiva.
And thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Shiva, look, just first off, let's talk about this fire, though. I mean, what exactly happened? Were you among those evacuated?
The whole building was evacuated, actually. I was actually quite close to the pavilions where one of the pavilions actually caught fire because there was an overload in the system. It was a bit chaotic initially, but I think the authorities did a really quick and beautiful job to try and get everyone out. And also it was nice to see how different blocks and different people from across the world was trying to just ensure that everyone was safely out of the building.
Absolutely. Well, glad to know that you guys are all safe. Shiva, as we get to the climate deal, though, what was actually agreed in this? And can you maybe share some of the key points?
Yeah, look, I can't sugarcoat this enough because I think the outcome was extremely weak. There was a lot of pressure from historical and current blockers of ambition. So that's why the outcome that came out really wouldn't address limiting global temperatures to 1.5 degrees. So there was nothing on mitigation, so around fossil fuel industries and targeting them. There was nothing in terms of finance and means of implementation. One thing that I guess positive that came out, however, it's been delayed by 5 more years, is adaptation finance, which is extremely important, I guess, for like the Pacific Island countries, etc. There's something that has come out, opened the door for outside the process because of just the pressure of so many countries within the system who was very unhappy with the outcome, that there will be a discussion on a roadmap to deforestation and a roadmap to fossil fuel phase out, but outside of the process, and hopefully that there's enough pressure put from all these countries that have been championing climate justice, that outside process discussions can filter into the inside the COP process.
Shiva, do you feel that the Pacific delegation that was there, what was the reaction from them knowing that this was what was reached at COP30?
Yeah, I think it was mixed. You know, some really wanted and pushed for high ambitions, like Vanuatu and Tuvalu. Some were just happy that something came out of this process and it didn't collapse. Because Pacific sometimes are stuck in between the process because partners like EU don't budge on finance, and then you've got like the Arab group of nations who don't budge on fossil fuel phase-out language. But they held the line. Many held the line to protect what was extremely important for us, which was the best available science and facts dictates the 1.5 degrees limit, as well as pushing for countries to go back and try and look at the NDCs and try and review that. So I felt the feelings were mixed because you want to get something out of this process, especially with the multilateral process being attacked by some parties and states who are taking a unilateral approach to undermine the climate crisis, and also which means then reduce ambition, where many climate vulnerable countries will get even further vulnerable because of just some selfish kind of approaches by certain states.
Well, obviously the agreement that has been reached is that, you know, Australia, Turkey have agreed to, you know, a deal over next year's COP. So Turkey will host the summit, but Australia will lead negotiations. I mean, there's even a talk of a pre-COP meeting held in the Pacific. I mean, what do you think of that outcome? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's disappointing, obviously, as a lot of resources and preparation had been started in the Pacific and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island communities, as well as civil society, and not to finally have a COP in the region that may really shift the dial on ambition. But it didn't eventuate. I think some within the Australian government didn't want to support the COP and didn't do enough, whereas people like Minister Bowen championed this with the Pacific. And in the end, the arrangements that have eventuated is complex. It's unique and not sure what meaningfully comes out of it, but the Pacific has a little bit of an opportunity for pre-COP. However, I do say that the biggest loss in all of this chaos has been the Pacific and the Indigenous people of Australia. But we just wouldn't know what the full extent of that agency will be for the Pacific leadership in the process, with only the pre-COP being in the Pacific and the region. So that will eventuate, I'm sure, in the couple of months from here, because Turkey, Australia and the Pacific needs to sit down together to ensure that there's a meaningful engagement in terms of ambition from the Pacific leadership.
Yeah, do you think that COP's credibility is dropping, though? You know, when you think about it, it just continuously becomes increasingly scrutinised, right? You have the influence of oil and fossil fuel corporations, and then, of course, some critics say COP has become some sort of Olympic event, right, where the host country is more interested in promoting itself. Your thoughts?
To be honest, yes, the credibility is dropping, but can it be salvaged? Yes, also. You know, we really need political will that is visionary. Also, the world needs it to work, because the Paris and the Paris Agreement is an example of it. You know, if we didn't have the Paris Agreement, the world would have been going towards 4 degrees Celsius rather than what they are currently approaching, which is 2 point something, which is still extremely detrimental and devastating for countries in the Pacific or any other climate vulnerable countries. But it has a lot of flaws to keep global temperatures within 1.5 degrees. And that is why we require political will to ensure that, yeah, we have a world that is a dignified world for the future generations to continue holding and practicing the things that they hold of value. But this multilateral process has been attacked by all sides, with the US, you know, how they've pulled out of it. And unfortunately, this is where you have a majority consensus decision, which means you make a decision for the whole world. So like I said, unfortunately, because you have a lot of blockers and a lot of different interests. But fortunately also is that you can see that there is 190-something countries who are unified in this to try and make sure that multilateralism works, because that is the only way we can collectively address the climate crisis in the most meaningful way across the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Shiva, that's all the time that we have, but always great to catch up with you. Thank you for your time.
You too. You too. Vinaka.
Vinaka. That is Greenpeace Pacific head Shiva Goundan. Well, as you would have heard, as you would have heard, after months of negotiations, Australia and Turkey have agreed to a deal over next year's COP. Again, Turkey will host the summit, but Australia will lead negotiations, and that there will be a pre-COP meeting held in the Pacific. Now, I know this decision has drawn some disappointment from Pacific leaders and advocates, so where to from here? On the line to unpack this is climate advocate and former director of the Global Centre for Social Justice and Advocacy Leadership, Alopi Latukefu. With that, I say mara tau mai bongbongini, Alopi.
Good morning. How are you?
I am well. Thank you so much. Look, I know you weren't at COP, though, but when you heard that Australia withdrew its bid to host COP31, you know, to sort of reach this compromise of Turkey, what was your initial reaction?
My initial reaction was that in some respects, while very disappointing, it wasn't unexpected in these sorts of fora. These things can change despite assumptions that may have been taken in, that it was in the bag, that in fact there's always the possibility that these things can not go the way of the hopeful host country, in this case Australia, and that has panned out. And we saw in some respects the geopolitics of the world as it is playing out at the COP meeting. I'm assuming that some of the reasoning around where Australia ended up was partly due to the fact that the numbers were not lining up in terms of support. So rather than not have it hosted with an opportunity to participate, Australia chose to look at the other option of finding a way to still have a hand in the game, still have a meeting in the Pacific, and to be a influential voice.
Do you feel, though, in any sense, LLP, that the Pacific has been let down, though, because of this decision?
I just think at this point, yes, in one respect, the expectation was raised that this next COP would be the one that would allow for the Pacific's situation to be brought to the world in a very clear way that was unfiltered by the process, but actually delivering people a very clear understanding from the region's perspective of the existential crisis that the region currently faces as a result of climate change. The one issue that's been consistently put forward by our leaders in the region as the most important issue from a security standpoint, from a human standpoint, from a general process of impact that's been happening over decades now. And, of course, huge disappointment with it not coming to our region, not coming to Australia, and for Australia to have the opportunity to stand up and be seen to be a leader for the region, which I think many in the Pacific were looking for.
Yeah. Well, we've got Australia's climate minister, right, Chris Bowen, who is expected to oversee COP31, even though it'll be hosted in Turkey. Does this in some way give you some reassurance that the Pacific will still have at least visibility at these talks?
Well, I think having Chris Bowen in the chair allows for the region to have a strong advocate and strong voice in negotiation, and someone who will put on the agenda the phase out of fossil fuels as a priority, something that he worked very hard to try and secure in earlier language, but which has faltered slightly in terms of the Belém process from what had been achieved earlier. There's also the issue of loss and damage for the region and the opportunity and for the world, and the opportunity to see investment to try and mitigate the impacts of climate change to the Pacific and others. All these issues, along with other many other issues that are now playing out, where, as we can see, climate change is no longer a marginal issue to be decided at some conference every year. This is an issue that is impacting everyone in the world now, and it's an everyday issue that we need to be talking about every day. And hopefully, with Bowen in the chair, looking at negotiations, with the Pacific having a meeting in the region, hopefully not in Australia, but actually in the region, we will see a realization from leaders of the world of the need for us to get serious about this, to actually see this as an opportunity for change.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, obviously the views that have been coming through, you know, people are very disheartened by the news. But talks again of a pre-COP meeting in the Pacific. Your thoughts? Where do you think this should be held?
Well, I think naturally it will need to probably be held in a place where it can be accommodating of leaders coming to the region. So my heart would say hold it in a place like Kiribati or Tuvalu, a smallest impacted state that is actually facing the most immediate crisis. But in reality, I think probably somewhere like Fiji makes a lot of sense, but potentially some of the other larger countries in the region who could host it, possibly Tonga. And the reason I mentioned Tonga is the Pacific Resilience Facilities in Tonga, and it would be wonderful to see the alignment of the focus that Australia's putting on into the PRF, Tonga's commitment to hosting it in Tonga, and seeing the, consolidation of a lot of effort that's been put in by the region to get a focus on what's needed for the future being pulled together in the discussions and being pulled together in the way in which leaders are brought into a consensus position. And, you know, that's a great opportunity that the Pacific, in the way the Pacific does business, can really hopefully move things along.
Absolutely. That is definitely a wait and see. But look, we appreciate your time, Alopi. That's all we have for this morning.
Oh, no, that's fine.
Again, malo apito for your time.
You're welcome.
And that is climate advocates and former director of the Global Centre for Social Justice and Advocacy Leadership, Alopi Latukefu.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Malo tamae pompongini. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Tupol. It has been 18 months since deadly riots took hold of Noumea. But there's more uncertainty than ever over the French territory's political future. It was hoped a recent visit by France's new overseas minister that would offer some answers over political and economic concerns. But she left with no firm, clear commitments made. One outcome of her meetings, though, however, was a split within the pro-independence coalition, the Kanaka and Socialist National Liberation Front, or FLNKS. Now, the Kanak Liberation Party, also known as Palika, left the coalition after 41 years of involvement. Then 5 days later, another moderate group, UPM, did the same, saying the coalition had become too violent and radicalised to stay. So to find out more, we are joined by Island business journalist Nick McLennan, who actually is joining us live from the studio. With that, I say good morning, Nick. Welcome.
Good morning, Aggie.
Appreciate you being here live in studio. Just for us to really have this conversation, I mean, goodness, let's start with FLNKS. I mean, it seems like it's sort of tearing apart at the seams. I mean, why are these moderate parties of the bloc packing their bags?
Right from the beginning, the FLNKS has been a coalition of parties founded in 1984. And the two biggest parties, who are at odds today, come from very different roots. Union Caledonienne dates back to the 1950s, came out of the churches in New Caledonia, and only took up a pro-independence policy in 1977. Palika was a younger generation, forged during the Vietnam War era, Black is Beautiful, and so on. First generation of leaders who went off to university in France in the late 60s and early 70s. They've been a significant force. They come out of different traditions, and they've always argued like cats and dogs, even united within the FLNKS. But that ended last year. In August 2024, the FLNKS held a congress following some months of rioting and conflict between Kanak protesters and French police. The two parties you've mentioned, Palika and UPM, had stood out of the congress. They refused to participate. They were critical of the eventual choice of Christian Taher as president of the FLNKS. Taher at the time was in jail in France, accused of serious crimes related to the conflict last year. He's since been released from pre-trial detention. They also disagreed with the plan to open up the front to other parties. There's a whole range of smaller pro-independence parties, such as the Labour Party, DUS from the Southern Province, a whole range of smaller groups. And, you know, those tensions came to a head. At the time, Palika and UPM suspended their involvement, but following the visit of Naima Mouchou, France's overseas minister, they've formally withdrawn from the front. It's a significant change and comes at a very difficult time for pro-independence supporters, simply because France is forging ahead to push through a new political statute to replace the framework that's governed New Caledonia for more than 25 years.
Wow. I do just want to roll back because you mentioned Christian Taher, right? Now, because he's the president, do you feel, though, that he's expected to remain president once he returns, you know, from France?
There's a lot of questions about his role. At the time of early in the conflict in June last year, seven key Kanak leaders affiliated with the CCAT, the network that had organised a lot of the protests, were taken in handcuffs in military aircraft to Paris. They were jailed in different prisons scattered across France and charged with really serious offences. Over time, the courts investigating these charges have dropped most of the serious charges. They still face some criminal prosecutions, but nothing like what they were first charged with. All of them have been released from prison. A couple have returned back to New Caledonia, and the others are proposing to do so in the near future. Tayana has played an interesting role because he was involved in negotiations last year at a place called Bougival, where political parties right across the spectrum came together to discuss this idea of a new political statute to replace the Numir Accord. So he's been a player in recent years since he's been out of prison, recent months since he's been out of prison. And I think there's a lot of concern from Palika that he'll play a significant role. But I think there's a lot of debate about the best way forward. And Palika and UPM have both said that they, in broad trends, support the Bougival process, the draft agreement that was forged in July last year. The FLNKS, remaining parties, in contrast, have formally rejected it and said they don't believe it's the basis for negotiations. So although both groups say they still want to support a move towards independence, they fundamentally disagree on the way to get there.
Mm. Nick, and let's talk about the Bougival Accord. You know, many people have said it's an ambitious proposal when it was put forward, but do you know the status of it right now?
It's quite complex. For years since the 2021 referendum in New Caledonia, it had been hard to get everyone around the table to talk about what comes next after the three referendums held for New Caledonia. That was finally achieved in February this year by Manuel Valls, who was then the overseas minister for France. He got all parties, including the FLNKS, including the so-called loyalist parties, to sit around the table and talk about what would they like to see in a new political framework. They prepared a draft which came together in July. However, very quickly, when the FLNKS leadership delegation came back, it was rejected by the FLNKS at a congress. The other parties, both loyalist and pro-independence, continue to support the broad frame of this agreement. There's a lot of controversy about it, though, because it contains elements that are quite unique in French law and indeed reject the standard UN decolonization principles. It proposes the idea of a state within a state, which seems like a really weird concept. And indeed, I've been trying to talk to international lawyers to explain how you can have a nation state within the French Republic. Right. There's elements that have been highlighted by the French government as significant changes. But when you read the detail of the agreement, it's pretty dodgy, which is why the FLNKS has rejected it. For example, it's proposed that the power over foreign affairs be handed from Paris to the government of New Caledonia. There are a number of major powers around defence, around security, police, courts, foreign affairs, which are held by the French state. It's proposed under the draft Bougival Agreement to give foreign affairs to the government of New Caledonia. Sounds really good that they could engage as members of the forum with neighbouring countries, do trade deals with Asian countries over nickel and things like that. But when you read the fine print of Bougival, I actually read the document, which is interesting, it goes beyond the headlines and it says, yes, New Caledonia can control foreign affairs as long as they follow French policy and the vital interests of the nation, quote unquote. So New Caledonia can have its own foreign affairs policy as long as it coincides with France. Now, there are some fundamental differences, say, over nuclear weapons, over maritime boundaries, the maritime boundary dispute with Vanuatu, over trade policy, whether nickel should be sold to Asian countries as they are now or to France. There are some pretty big differences between what's happening in Paris and what's happening in Noumea, and the Bougival Accord says that any foreign policy initiatives have to be in line with France's fundamental policies. That's why there's a whole lot of complexities in this agreement, and many parties have talked about the need to amend the draft that was developed last July. Whether that can be done, very difficult to see.
That's the thing, though, right? When FLNKS told the overseas minister last week they just want full and complete sovereignty, right? How then does the Bougival Accord move forward, knowing that that's their stance?
When she left, Naima Mushu, the new overseas minister who replaced Manuel Valls, didn't really spell that out. However, just over the last couple of days, since she returned to Paris, she's spoken before the French Parliament and said that they're going to reverse the process that was proposed by her predecessor. The current framework agreement, the Noumea Accord, is entrenched in the French constitution. So to get rid of it, have a new political statute, you have to go through a long parliamentary process passed by the National Assembly, the French Senate, a joint sitting of both houses, and then it was going to be put to a referendum of New Caledonians in February. She's now proposed to turn that process around, to have the referendum first in early March next year, and then amend the law afterwards. That seems really crazy because New Caledonians are going to be asked to vote yes or no on the draft text of the agreement that was adopted last July. Now, many parties say they want to amend the treaty, tweak it, keep the broad framework, but tweak the thing. The FLNK says we want to get rid of the whole lot. So it's clear there's no consensus around the draft that was prepared last July, and yet it's proposed to be put to the people of New Caledonia without it going through a parliamentary process in France.
Which, how do you think that'll play out?
I don't think it is going to play out, simply because there's a lot of political chaos in France that's unrelated to New Caledonia. President Macron has lost standing in the public opinion polls. Last poll I saw, 70% of people want him to resign. So he's very unpopular within France. His current Prime Minister, Sébastien Lecornu, has been trying to get a budget through the French Parliament. The first part of the budget was put to the National Assembly a couple of days ago and was rejected 404-1. So France has to get its own national budget together. They haven't done so. So there's the possibility that the Lecornu government may not last, that Lecornu might lose a no-confidence motion in the parliament. There'd have to be new elections. Or there's chaos politically in Paris. And that's having enormous problems for people in New Caledonia who are waiting for financial assistance from the French government in the aftermath of last year's clashes.
Yeah.
So this timetable was difficult at the beginning. They can't get the legislative changes through this year, so they basically reversed the process. That creates new problems. It's a mess. It's a mess. And I think the real problem for ordinary New Caledonians is they'd like a period of certainty to rebuild the economy that was badly damaged last year during the clashes. They'd like tourism revived. Currently it's at about half the level of pre-conflict. There's a lot of problems with employment. One in six people lost their jobs last year, 13.5% drop in GDP. The economy is in real trouble, and Paris hasn't got a budget.
Well, yes, so that's what I'm saying. Is France even in a position to pledge more financial assistance to New Caledonia, knowing that they have got their own spending woes?
Well, it's very noticeable that Naima Mouchou was approached by business leaders last week and didn't give firm commitments. For example, the French government has been providing subsidies to employers to keep on workers. A lot of people lost their jobs, a lot of businesses closed last year, and they had a system a bit like we had in Australia, like JobKeeper during the COVID period, where the government would subsidise wages to keep people on so they didn't all get sacked. Now, it's due to run out on the 30th of November, which is about to tick. When she met the business community, business leaders, during her visit last week, Naima Mouchou refused to confirm whether they'd extend it till the middle of next year, as many bosses were asking. And it's pretty clear that she couldn't make that commitment because she didn't know what was going to be in the budget. And already the draft budget prepared by the current Lecornu government in France, the overseas ministry has an 18.5% cut in the budget. So she couldn't promise what she couldn't deliver. And that's still the situation. There's an uncertainty about what's going to happen politically, economically for New Caledonia until there's a level of certainty in France. This has implications for French Polynesia and further places as well. I interviewed President Amortai Brotherson of French Polynesia at the time of the forum this year, and he was hoping that Manuel Valls would be continued as overseas minister because French Polynesia had negotiated a number of conventions around health and education and other areas. They'd put forward budget proposals. Now with a new minister, they've got to start again all those discussions. And so there's a level of uncertainty, a level of doubt about the future, and yet people are being asked to go to the polls in early March to decide on a new political framework. It's not a good situation, and there are many people on all sides of politics who fear it might all fall apart.
So sounds like there's a lot of pressure at the moment for Paris to perform.
There is, and, you know, it's in many areas. Having said that, the government is forging ahead. The current Prime Minister, Sébastien Lecornu, was overseas minister in 2021 during the COVID period. And one of the reasons the FLNKS are so distrustful is at that time, Lecornu pushed through the third referendum under the Noumir Accord in the middle of the COVID pandemic. People, particularly on the pro-independence side, said, don't do that. We need time to sort this out. Let's delay it till 2022. But he forged ahead. And the overwhelming majority of independence supporters just stayed away from the polls. Then again, your listeners will remember that last year, President Macron and other ministers wanted to change voting rights for New Caledonia. There was a series of peaceful protests in early 2024, but Macron and his ministers forged ahead to unilaterally change this, once again without support from the FLNKS and other independence parties. And that was the trigger for the riots and conflict that broke out in May last year. A terrible time. 15 people died, 2,600 arrested, hundreds injured. Many businesses closed their doors. One in six people lost their jobs. Tourism and the nickel industry collapsed. New Caledonians are still living with the economic, social trauma of that time. Mm. And this ongoing uncertainty about what happens next is causing a lot of grief. People I've spoken to on all sides of politics are really uncertain about how this will play out. And they feel that Paris is not really addressing fundamental concerns that have been on the table for a long time.
That is the case. Well, look, Nick, that is all the time that we have for this morning. Really appreciate you coming into the studio.
Thanks as always, Aggie.
That is Island business journalist Nick McLennan joining us live in the studio here on Pacific Beat.
Want the latest Pacific Rugby League and Union news and interviews with stars of the game? Tune in to Nation Footy with Sam Wykes and Tinirau Arona.
He is an absolute beast, man. He's like UT. It's your size, but just probably about 10 kilos
wider,
thicker, thick, yeah, thick top dude. Of bloke, yeah. That's fast. So everything
like,
opposite to you.
Like
Nation Footy, Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for joining us here on Pacific Beat. It is that time we head around the region. We've got your producer, Carl Evans, bringing you the latest headlines. And he's in studio with me this morning. Good morning, sir. Did you have a good weekend?
I did have a good weekend, Aggie. Yeah, this actually might be the most nervous I've ever been for NewsWrap because I've got to follow the great Nick McLellan, who is something to behold live in the studio.
You could literally sit here all day and listen to him. Yeah, it was good to have him in the studio. Okay, well, let's head back to our stories. First, we're starting with Fiji. They had to reassure tourists again after some bad publicity raised questions about potential alcohol poisoning. My goodness, what happened here?
Yes, Aggie. So this topic, it's obviously been a thorn in the side of the Fiji tourism industry over the last 12 months. And just when they thought it was all in the rearview mirror, it's produced some more brand damage. This time it's come by way of the UK Foreign Office, who has updated its travel advice by placing Fiji on a list of countries that poses risk to tourists for methanol poisoning from tainted alcoholic drinks.
Goodness.
So according to the BBC, the list featured around 25 countries all up. It actually also included PNG well, along with other places such as Mexico, Indonesia, even Japan as well, which I found quite interesting. And it's all likely in response to that unfortunate incident which happened last year when seven people were hospitalised after drinking those pina coladas at a five-star resort. And that came only weeks after a number of tragic deaths were recorded in Laos as well. So, not great news on that front.
Carl, though, has authorities responded?
Yes, they responded very, very quickly, Aggie, with Deputy PM and Minister for Tourism, Bill Gavoka. He was quick to address it, saying nothing harmful was found in the drinks following the tests that were conducted in Fiji and New Zealand.
Okay.
And tourism operators maintain the highest of standards. That being said, though, look, a lot of people would read the UK travel
That's
advice,
right.
So I'm sure that will hurt in some ways.
Okay, well, let's head to Samoa because authorities there have intercepted a shipment of methamphetamine hidden within frozen chicken. My goodness.
That's right, Aggie. So 1.4 kilograms of meth was seized after a targeted operation uncovered the shipment, which was actually coming in from American Samoa. Now, there's been many and new and different ways that drugs have been transported in recent times across the Pacific. A box of frozen chickens, though, seems like a first that I can recall anyway reporting on.
Sure.
However, it is another example of the tactics being used by organisations and criminal groups, and look, as we've learned in recent months, nothing is off limits. Luckily, customs officials were on the ball. They picked up the meth during the screening process,
okay,
and the man who imported the shipment was detained.
All right, okay then. Let's head to sport because I feel like this is some good news. The fixture has been released for next year's Rugby League World Cup.
Yes, that's right, Aggie. I'll read off the press release here. So this isn't a promotional campaign for the NRL, but it does sound pretty good. Three tournaments, 14 nations, 26 teams, 53 matches over 31 days in what's being described as the most ambitious Rugby League World Cup yet. Now, look, to be fair, I would agree with that. I can remember the days when the Rugby League World Cup went for about 2 weeks and it would be played very late at night. So, no, it certainly has come a very long way. It's going to be played across three countries this year, Australia, New Zealand and Papua New Guinea. There's going to be 9 host cities. It's going to feature, obviously, men, women and the wheelchair competitions.
Nice.
Now, the men's tournament's going to include 10 teams, one pool of 4 and 2 pools of 3, which I haven't seen done before either. So Group A is going to feature Australia, New Zealand, Fiji and the Cook Islands. England, Samoa and Lebanon will make up Group B, and Tonga, PNG and France will make up Group C. Now, here's where it gets quite interesting, though. Group A are only going to play against each other. However, Groups B and C will actually play 3 matches against the teams in the adjacent group. So that sort of paves the way for some pool matches, you know, between some Pacific nations, probably most notably Tonga and Samoa. And, you know, I guess if they advance from there, they could meet each other again in the knockout stages. So, yeah, a bit of an interesting way of doing things, but I'm here for it. I like it.
Yeah, that'll be a clash for sure. Where will the final be played?
Yes, good question, Aggie. So Brisbane Suncorp Stadium has secured the final, which I got to say is, I love that decision. We've obviously had plenty of finals hosted in the past in Sydney, but I'm not sure if there's been one in Brisbane before. But like I said before, there's going to be games played across three countries. So we're going to have games in Port Moresby. We're going to have games in New Zealand. But even some of those Australian cities that are very much rugby league heartland, places like Newcastle, Wollongong, there'll obviously be games in Sydney as well. Might be a game or two in Townsville. So, yeah, it really is going to travel the country, and it's just going to be a huge logistical operation.
I have to ask though, Carl, are you thinking you're going to go to one of these games?
I didn't see Melbourne on the fixture. I'll have to look a little bit closely. I really had to rush through news wrap today, but I'll look a little bit closely after the show. But look, I would love to. I'd love to go. I love going to regional cities to watch professional sport.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the idea of going to a game in Wollongong or Newcastle or Townsville would really, really appeal to me. But look, absolutely. My wife, actually, believe it or not, she's really gotten into rugby league in recent times.
Nice.
She's been at me to go to a Melbourne Storm game at some point next season, so that's definitely on the schedule. But no, a Rugby League World Cup, that's something I haven't
something
done
to
before
look forward to, though.
And something that's definitely on the bucket list. Before we go, though, do want to give a quick shout-out to the Vanuatu Men's National Football Team, who have won the Melanesian Cup, as well as the Papua New Guinea National Women's Team, who won the Women's Melanesian Cup in Port Moresby. So, look, congratulations to them.
Well done to them, absolutely. Carl, look, as always, great to have you come through the studio to share with us our latest in the headlines around the region.
Thank you, Aggie.
What's up, ABC Radio Australia listeners? I'm Sosafina Formoli, and I want you to come hang with me for On The Record, your weekly deep dive into the music that moves the Pacific. We'll talk about the big tracks that inspire your favourite Pacific music artists and the real stories behind them. Plus, we'll uncover some gems that you might not know yet. keeping the heart of the Pacific alive and thumping. Catch On The Record Mondays at 3 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
15 Lover, thank you for joining us here on Pacific Beat. Well, as we wrap up, freedom of the press in Samoa has taken a hit, with the country's only independent newspaper, the Samoa Observer, being banned from government news conferences. Samoa's Prime Minister, Lauri Leautea Schmidt, made the announcement on Monday, citing a lack of journalism ethics. It comes just over 2 months since the new Prime Minister was sworn in. Whenau Whanua files this report.
Ask me questions that you know there will be something for you or Samoa and the nation tomorrow.
This was the press conference where a Samoa Observer journalist was ordered to leave, informed that Samoa's Prime Minister didn't want her to be there. In that presser, Prime Minister Lauri Leautea Schmidt told the media he was putting a temporary ban on the Samoa Observer from attending any press engagements with him or his cabinet. A press statement was later issued in which he accused the newspaper of false reporting. He also accused the Samoa Observer editor of trespassing his residence. The statement read,
"While I recognize the competitive nature of the media, it is vital, however, that this does not come at the expense of accuracy, fair, factual, and responsible journalism, especially given the influence media has on public perception and trust."
That sort of thing can be addressed through the law, but instead he has taken an action as a leader to arbitrarily ban one media organisation based on his dismay.
Veteran Samoan journalist and media scholar Langipoiva Cheryl Jackson says, although door-stopping leaders is culturally inappropriate in Samoa, there was no reason why the Prime Minister couldn't seek help from defamation and harassment laws. She says the Prime Minister's move undermines transparency, as the Samoa Observer is the only independent newspaper in the country.
There are systems in place to address those things in a legal way that doesn't have to be resorted to targeting one specific media house. This is becoming a pattern for him, where he is treating the media in such a way. I actually shudder to think what his next steps would be.
Freedom and independent journalism is an essential public good. Journalists, we must be able to report freely without fear or favour.
Samoa Observer editor Shelvin Chan says it's not the first time Lauri has taken aim at the newspaper, and that he has a long history of censoring media.
When he was campaigning as a leader of the FAST party, there were certain occasions where we actually caught him out and we questioned him about the statements he had made which were untrue. And one of those statements he made about the former Prime Minister, in which the former Prime Minister is actually taking him to court and suing him for $550,000.
Samoa Observer has since issued an email to the Prime Minister rebuking his allegations and demanding clarifications around his claims.
We're the only newspaper on the island. We're the only independent print newspaper. We've got the largest online following. So, yes, it does affect press freedom in Samoa.
Samoa Observer digital manager Jarrett Malifa says the restrictions imposed on his newspaper are a blatant attack on media freedom, and it interferes with the media's ability to hold powers to account.
If we can't ask questions of our leaders, we can't hold them accountable, then it affects everyone. We want to know, we want the public to be informed, and also with our government to be held accountable. Transparency is a cornerstone of democracy, and especially with leaders, elected leaders.
And that was Jarrett Malifa of the Samoa Observer. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Now, if you want to find our top stories, type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. Our team will be back at the same time at 6 a.m. PNG time tomorrow, but you can always hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it's Nita Daily. So until next time, o tō awhātou. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Thank you.